Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Time for us to turn back to the Gaelic Players Association. They released their 2019 annual report yesterday. They held their AGM last night, and in between that, we sat down with Paul Flynn yesterday afternoon. Here's how the conversation went.
All right, we have Paul Flynn, the Chief Executive of the GPA, with us. The AGM of the Gaelic Players Association is out. The annual report has been published on their website, so there's an opportunity for everybody to kind of parse through exactly where we are at the moment and where the organisation is making progress and where they see the future going. Before I get into all of that, Paul, the circumstances for the last couple of months when you've been preparing the annual report for 2019 is actually circumstances from a different world, where there was a championship and there was vibrant sponsorship and there were bums on seats and there was broadcasting deals that were all heading one direction. So in terms of the impact that COVID has had and what it might have for the future of your organization as well as the wider world, what's your kind of instinct about where things are going at the moment?
Thanks, Cher. It's good to be on as well. I think it was very strange to be delivering on an annual report of 2019. It feels like a very long time ago, considering what we've just gone through and what we continue to go through in relation to living with COVID-19 in our lives. Absolutely no different to any organisation, sport or otherwise. There will be implications on the GAA, as we all know, and as well reported, but also on the GPA, as we have a partnership in relation to commercial revenue share there. So we are keen through COVID and since the start of it to focus on two things: to make sure that we preserve our cash, but also ensuring that we can deliver our service provision to our players too, and arguably at a time where they need it now more than ever before because of the implications of COVID is having, no different to the wider society, but also on players also.
Do you expect Sport Ireland to come through with the same level of grants for 2020 as they would have done in previous years? Is that even a conversation at the moment?
Well, we only have a new government, so I'm looking forward to getting in and discussing that with government and with Sport Ireland. But as I'm sure everybody is under no illusions of the implications on the economy based off of COVID.
Okay, so we keep an eye out to kind of see what's happening. In terms of the annual report, there's obviously a huge interest from the wider GAA community in what the direction that the GPA are trending in. And it seems, if I'm looking through the report this morning and looking back at the ESRI report, that fixtures is going to continue to be this thing which seems to be the kind of black hole that draws everybody's attention. And it might actually be the original sin of the GAA is not getting the fixture list corrected at some point. Where does that stand and where does that fit into all of the rest of the stuff that you end up talking about when the publication happens? What level of importance do the GPA place on fixing the fixtures?
Well, ultimately, Jay, we do three things: player representation, player welfare, and player development. And under player representation, this is top of the agenda. And it has an indirect impact on the player welfare and also on player development. So it's transient across everything that we do. We invested last year heavily into the Fixtures Task Force, which we remain committed to. And because since my first day in this role, probably not knowing a hell of a lot about the difficulties that I faced in relation to fixture reform, I did feel that the only way to find a solution was to have all the different stakeholders in the one room, and we need to find a consensus. And ultimately, that was what happened through the Fixtures Task Force. And the findings of the report have been outlined. There's three recommendations. But the next steps of the report were to do a roadshow across the country, outlining the findings to clubs, to counties, getting the feedback, and then outlining a way forward, let's say. Don't get me wrong, there's looking at the fixtures, the findings of the fixtures task force, now through the lens of what we've just experienced, it does make changes. And I believe the next step should be getting the group together again, looking at the learnings from what we've just experienced now to a very condensed season, and then continuing with the roadshows that were supposed to be face-to-face through digital platforms. So we could do it in a much more timely manner, and then we can find a solution that works for all. We certainly don't need there to be unrest amongst the GA community going forward because of fixtures, which we now know we can't fix, we can't find a solution to.
When it comes to that fixture, sorry, George, just on that fixture task force, when you said it was a consensus, or at least there was a consensus as part of the ambition, was there one of the options that you had nailed down before coronavirus that was the one that you were going to be really pushing this summer?
There was one, four by eight, which was groups of four by eight and the linked. But equally, we hadn't done our roadshow. That was my preference, to be fair. We hadn't done our own internal roadshow with the players, and it was built into our AGM, funny enough, as a workshop in our AGM. But as you're aware, our AGM is through a Teams call, which isn't the right form for us unless we are to adapt it, like I just highlighted there. So again, I think the next steps are to get the group back together, look at it through the lens of COVID. Have we learned anything? Could we amend anything? And then go with the roadshows with the collateral prepared and the information dissected for people to understand. But there could be changes because of, as I said, the more condensed season we're going to experience.
That condensed season has given the opportunity for the club to have a period of time, and then the intercounty is going to have a period of time. Let's assume that the intercounty season goes ahead, and hopefully there'll be even more supporters allowed at those games than we have at the moment. Is that part of the model something that we should actually think about, where there's just a period of exclusivity for clubs, and then after that there's a period where training continues and then the game starts? It seems like we might have stumbled upon something perfect here.
I do believe that this is a good solution for this year. We'd have to look at whether it's the right solution going forward. We have to remember that in every week that there's football or hurling being played this year, inter-county players are asked to play. So when we talk about split seasons, or we talk about whatever model, under every one of the banners or the headings, inter-county players will be asked to play. So you need to ensure that the proper sports science is embedded within it, to ensure that there's load management, there's player welfare, understandings around injury prevention and preparation. And I think that's really, really important. I don't feel that that's fully understood and accepted by the wider GAA community. When we think about, yes, the preparation for intercounty is a greater requirement than club. It's an extra 10 minutes. The players are conditioned to a higher level. And the games of club championship first this year will to prepare them to a certain level. But under no illusions, like, training at an intercounty level is like playing any championship game. And that's the level that we're at. And we need to make sure players are given the adequate time, intercounty players, to prepare for the intercounty season. So in a long-winded way, I do believe that we have stumbled along a solution for this year. It would be naive of us and silly of us not to learn from what we've just experienced, and hopefully we can then drive on and progress the fixtures reform.
So there should be some access to intercounty level sports science for intercounty players during a club season. Would that be, I'm saying that they could train with them once a week, as opposed to it being an exclusive window for, I guess, maybe a relaxation of the rules where there's no access to the intercounty management teams and their setups, the players, if this was something that might work into the future, where there was a couple of months a year where you're allowed to train with your county, you're allowed to use their sports science facilities, for want of a better word, and then you can go and continue to play with your clubs. Might that be some kind of hybrid version of what we're seeing this year that might work?
And look, Jerry, I think there's a lot of what you just said there that makes is common sense, and I think that needs to come into this. I personally believe that we should go with intercounty first, and if you finish your intercounty, then there won't be, you'll be completely free to play with their clubs, and there might be less of what we just experienced over the last number of weeks. But equally, if it was the other way around, or if there was some sort of hybrid, there's, by allowing inter-county players to do a strength and conditioning session in a club period, is no detriment to the club. into the latter, actually, I'd say. And at the moment, we have no club gyms that are allowed open. But we have inter-county players that aren't allowed to train in the inter-county facility, which is a gym, and they could do it on an evening off from their club activities. They can't access a rehabilitation session with their sports physios and medical teams. So, you know, this is what we've the environment we're in at the moment, where it's completely split. But I do feel that if we can find a proper solution going forward, we need to ensure that common sense is built into it as well.
How do you feel that you guys have performed in terms of getting that voice out there? Because we're talking about perceptions a good bit here, and it seems as if at the moment you're constantly fighting a battle to explain exactly what your position is. How do you fix that? What's the process for you guys to be a voice that people turn to and go, okay, well, what is your perception on this, and that you get listened to, as opposed to beaten up for your press releases, which kind of seems to be the case at the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's the difference between perception and reality. And unfortunately, reality is different to people's perceptions. My take on this is very clear. Like, our key stakeholder in this is the inter-county players. And because we are the representative body of the inter-county players, the 2%, as some people like to highlight it as, that's our role. We need to continue to represent them. And some of the things, Jair, that we aim to achieve may not appease everyone, but we have to just be happy in the fact that we are representing our core membership, the inter-county players. So I think that's always going to create some level of, I'm not going to use conflict, a bit strong, but we're not always going to be in agreement with everybody's views of the world, because people will be strong in relation to one side or the other. I think what sometimes gets lost in it, JR, is that all inter-county players are club players too. They're all delighted to be back with their clubs, training hard, raising the levels of inter-county, of club championship, club training. It's excellent. Talking to many of them, they're enjoying the bit more space that they have at the moment. But equally, they're high performers here, and they want to get back into that high performing environment and to test themselves against the best. And so, I guess, going back to your question, we're the representative body of the inter-county players. Everybody loves the inter-county players, but they hate the GPA, or misunderstand the GPA, I'd say. And so it's important that we continue just to get our message out there. And that's why, Jair, with our annual report, from my perspective, if everyone wants to go through it and read it and see all the things, the different things that we do for the players, who they do admire, I think they get a greater appreciation for the breadth of what we do. And fixture reform certainly is one of the main items on our agenda, but it's not the only item. And there's a suite of other things that we do across player development and player welfare that maybe people just don't understand fully.
Off the back of the ESRI report last year, the drop quote from Eilish Kelly, just to read it out, who was the lead author of the report, she said, "Unless the underlying drivers that are giving rise to the current inter-county commitment levels are identified and addressed, the knock-on effects identified in this study are likely to be amplified among future generations of players." It's the old adage, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat the mistakes. And essentially, that's the 31 hours that has become kind of a, again, it's interesting. You guys get blamed for the 31 hours, and yet it's your members who are the ones who are suffering the impact of it. So presumably you guys want fewer than 31 hours to be the level of commitment that is required from inter-county players into the future.
Absolutely, Chair. It's a number that people refer to, and I don't mind who they blame for it. What we need to do is collectively to reduce it. And one of the motions that we're bringing to the floor of the AGM this evening is the idea of, you actually might recall from, what's a separate motion is in relation to Don Davis, but we'll come back to that. But a second motion we're bringing is around optimal contact hours. And the idea of contact hours is widely recognized in different sports, based off sports science. How many hours per week would a professional athlete train? Obviously, we're not a professional sport, but we can learn from professional sports, like what we do on the pitch, from an S&C perspective and conditioning. We should be embedding that in how inter-county setups are training. And I was a firm believer that when under Jim Gavin's regime, we trained less than every other county. And I believe, I still believe that. And it was because it was heavily based in sports science and smart training. And I think if we can do the same with the optimal contact hours, we can reduce the 31-hour requirements based on inter-county players. And hopefully one of the outcomes of COVID, maybe a positive outcome, is a trend towards working from home and the impact, or working locally or working remote, and the impact potentially that can have on players not having to travel the distances that they had to travel, because a lot of that 31 hours in many instances was made up of traveling.
What is the optimal contact hour in your view? I know it's probably a bit of a hunch and that there's going to be research done to actually nail it down, but from your experience, what is that number?
Owen, I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to that question. There's sports scientists out there who'll be able to identify that. But I do believe that four nights a week is the ideal. One strength conditioning, two pitch, and one weekend, and there's a scope for the strength conditioning to be more localized, and because it is all personal. Your strength conditioning program now is personal to you, and more trends rather than a collective program. So there is opportunities for that session to be done in your own setting. So. But I just think we need to be creative about it, Owen. I think we need to be forward thinking. And one of the key things that we continue to try and embed as a part of our culture in the GPA and intercounty games is balance between a player's personal, professional, and their physical life. And to be able to find that balance, we need to create space. And at the moment, Jair, I don't know whether you remember Don Davis's reference to the 31 hours, and he did it in a quite jovial manner. But it doesn't leave a hell of a lot more space when you include sleep and work in there to do anything else. And I think it's important that we understand that, but find solutions to reduce it.
Just on that, Paul, would it be a situation that there is a guideline on whatever the hours would be? So say, I don't know what it could be, 21, 25 hours. Would there then be a mandate from the GPA to say to every county board, this is how much you're allowed to train your team? And if that is the case, how do you implement that? How do you actually ensure that those rules are actually being adhered to? Because I think that was one of the big talking points of recent weeks, when Tom Ryan said that players and county boards should be called out for training. And I think that's something that really stuck in the craw of a lot of people, whereas perhaps from the GPA statement, as much criticism as it got, there was a sense of reality in the idea that players need to be insured because there is a culture in the GA of rules being skirted. So in kind of a roundabout way then, if you were to come up with a new contact hours rule, how do you implement it?
Good point. And I think the idea of culture is important, that there needs to be a change in culture overall in the overall association to understand if we are to achieve sustainable amateurism, which is the core of what we believe should be the foundation of the GAA, it needs to be able to strike a balance between all the different elements of it. And one of the things around adherence to rules and adherence to policies is paramount for it to be able to deliver on some of this best practice ideas that other sports do utilize. And I feel that education is important in relation to this also, that if all inter-county setups understood what it is required to perform at the optimal, based off sports science, obviously, that they wouldn't have to overtrain. So I guess that it's just going to take all stakeholders to come together. No different to what we had to achieve over the last number of weeks. County boards, ourselves, the GAA, need to work together to be able to strike this balance.
What they do in the NFL, and Don Davis was from the NFL Players Association, is that the union representative will report if the team does a contact session that they're not supposed to do. And also there are people who travel around whose job it is to make sure that the sessions aren't in pads, or they're not supposed to be in pads, and all that kind of stuff. So how do you police something like this if it does come in? Because you can see this happening really quickly, where there's a general acceptance that this is a big step forward. It'll cost the GAA less money, which would presumably get them on board pretty quickly too. So how do you police it?
It's a good, Jerry, I'm not entirely certain if you've seen the three motions for this evening, but one of the motions that we have, and that's what I was alluding to earlier on, being brought to the floor this evening is around a confidential disclosure platform. And it's ultimately off the back of the ESRI report and the student report, whereby players are crying out for an off season. So this is for a reporting mechanism to allow players to report non-compliance to the off season. So that was, as I alluded to earlier, when I mentioned Don Davis, it was Don who educated me in that platform that the NFL Players Association have. Theirs is around contact, physical contact, because of the prevalence of injuries. But equally, ours is due to the player welfare, prevalence of injury, but also in relation to downtime and balance. A platform like this could be utilized in that manner. So we can set that up, use it for an off season. If the platform was working and there's engagement with it, that could be then rolled out and used for the contact hours also.
Okay. It all makes, as you say, common sense. And hopefully post-COVID, we're all going to get an injection of that. Can I ask you about off-seasons? What do you mean by an off-season? Do you mean an off-season when there's no inter-county, or do you mean there's no club on and inter-county, so players get a genuine break? What's your definition of that?
Selfishly looking at it from an inter-county player's perspective, I believe that the month of December should be completely off-season. There should be no activity. And that could change based off what happens in fixture reform. But as is, it should be an off-season where guys are just allowed to have complete downtime. The only thing at the moment where that would be impeded is when you're talking about colleges and you're talking about provincials that have been now moved to December. But you would achieve a high proportion of an off season by shutting down intercounty in December. However, by looking at the fixture reform, we have one of the key principles we brought in was around an off season, and it should be paramount to the whole GA. I think it's not a bad thing for the whole association to shut down for a month.
And that's where some common ground could be found between you guys and the CPA, for example, or you guys and club players, where it's all GAA activity stops and everybody hits a reset button.
Absolutely. And we did come out with a press release in conjunction with the CPA after they decided to step away from the fixtures task force, because we did understand that there's a lot of areas of common ground. And as I highlighted, like, all inter-county players are club players as well. But we need to understand that in any season whereby you split it, or you do a hybrid, or you do a concurrent, or whatever model it is, inter-county players are asked to play at each one of those. So we just need to make sure that we are protecting the interests of our players.
Paul, could I just ask then on the subject, kind of again, of affecting change and making sure it actually happens? Like, there's really good ideas in terms of your research, bringing the relative fixture proposals on road shows, researching what the optimal contact hours are for training. To actually affect that change, to actually get that over the line, that can often be a complicated process. You sometimes see great motions, for example, go before Congress and they get defeated. Some people will say that the GPA are too close to the GEA to be able to have the necessary arguments to get these over the line. Is that something that you might have concerns about in the future, that you need to sort of keep a distance from the GEA? But how do you end up doing that if you are quite close to the GEA and essentially funded in part by the GEA?
No, it's a really good question, and I believe in a partnership model, and you know, where there's a respect across the board, we respect them, they respect us, and in any relationship like that, that doesn't mean that we have to agree on every point, and that doesn't mean that we can't push the boundaries, and I believe that we can still do that in a partnership model, no different to some of the policies that we've been trying to bring forward so far, you know, even from last year's AGM. They do take time, and this year in particular, because of COVID, they have been delayed. But one of the other interesting policies we discussed last year was around competitive balance. There hasn't been a hell of a lot spoken about this year in the media spheres, but it's really important from our perspective, is the whole idea of uncertainty of outcome. And that's from learnings that we had from the AFL Players Association. They rolled this out in 2016 because there was, I suppose, a number of teams that were underperforming and they were trying to bring balance to it. And I believe this would be a fantastic initiative to be rolled out by the GAA from right across the board, but in particular in the inter-county setup. and it could bring greater competitions. And some of it can be done through fixture reform, competition reform, and other can be done through funding and through other mechanisms. So, but they do take time on. There are things in the GA that take time, just purely based off the setup and the Congress and how what it takes to change a rule.
And can I just ask then, are you content with that partnership at the moment? And I know that can be kind of an awkward question to ask because you have to work with the GEA quite often, but is that constantly under review, the fact that that partnership doesn't necessarily always have to be a partnership? Sometimes change can be affected if you're outside the tent. Like, is that always up for consideration with GPA, because it is a constant criticism?
Absolutely, and I do feel the criticism comes because of a lack of understanding. And like, even in my tenure in this role, I've had many arguments, public and behind the scenes, with the GAA. But equally, the next day I may have to enter into a room and work on a program of work that we've been trying to get over the line. So that's an understanding between ourselves and the GAA that we're not always going to agree, and we will continue to represent the inter-county players and their interests under the three pillars of welfare, development and representation. And back to your point, Jerry, earlier on in relation to perception, people won't always agree with what we're trying to achieve because we represent the inter-county players, and that's just a part of it. But equally, they won't always understand the idea of our relationship with the GAA as well.
Could you just give us a couple of quick sentences on competitive balance and what it is and how it might actually impact games, for example?
Well, ultimately, the idea in the AFL was, their North Star, let's call it, was to increase the uncertainty of outcome of games. And that's what they were aiming to achieve. Because there were some teams that were far superior than others, and I think there were only 18 teams within their league, and they wanted to bring balance to it. Other sports do it through different formats, like salary caps and financial fair play and so forth. So it's the idea of competitive balance and equalization strategies within sport are common. We've yet to grasp it within the GAA, but it's something that I feel that we could, we would have to radically change it from professional sports, but we take it, the model, the idea, and we learn from it. Things like spending caps for squads, so there's fairness across the board, team sizes, squads sizes, the format of championships. So there's a number of different ways you could look at it, but a bit like contact hours on, we don't have all the answers to this, but what we do have is we've a will to find them. And we actually had set up a group to start looking at this on the 19th of March. Unfortunately, we have had to delay it, but it's right on our agenda, and we believe we'll have it completed by the end of the year. But we're going to embed it in the negotiation strategies also.
Okay, so it'll be a conversation to be had at central level with GAA, but how, so that players training in counties can feel like they're going to have a crack at something, a meaningful outcome in a competition that they believe they have a chance of winning.
Exactly, Joe.
I think we could all get behind that. Maybe splitting Dublin should be top of the agenda for that one. I mean, that's always something. That's an agenda we like to push on this show, Paul.
All right, sorry. I didn't tune in for that episode.
Paul Flynn, thanks very much for joining us. Best of luck.
Thanks, guys. OTB
AM. We start with the GPA.
Yeah.
Donal O'Neill last night. Like always, a good person to listen to when these stories come up, whenever there's an annual report, really, just to kind of get the history of the GPA, but also his general take on what's going on at the moment. And he basically feels that the GAA are now compromised in their situation, that they are negotiating a new deal with the GAA. They have been negotiating deals with the GAA for the last little while. It's different to the GPA that Donal O'Neill would have been part of when it was founded, where they were very much outside the tent. Compared them to a civil service at the moment. One gem of a line in here, which I hadn't heard before, he says, "I remember back in the day, Desi Farrell took counsel from Gerry Adams at one point. And the advice was, if you're going to go in and take the dollar, then make sure you get what you go in for. Go in hard and strike that deal once, because you will only do it once." I'd never heard the Gerry Adams anecdote before, to be honest.
Essentially, Gerry Adams said, go heavy or go home. Is that what I'm hearing there? Right.
Like, bring your best negotiating tactics to the table is what Gerry Adams said. I'd be keen to hear that anecdote in full and what exactly happened, and if he's had his finger in the GPA pie in terms of influence in other areas before, but that's for another day. In the current GPA situation, then, Paul Flynn obviously did a lot of media yesterday, was with us this morning. Like, will we talk about what he said at the end there, Ger? The idea of the competitive balance and what that might mean for the future of the GPA, because I think we've spoken a lot about the annual report and put a few questions to Paul Flynn on that. But it is interesting that that is going to be one of the next things that they tackle, is the lack of competitive balance in the GEA. And it's very interesting as well that the man who will spearhead that is a former Dublin footballer. And I know we will joke about the fact that we're trying to split Dublin in two, maybe not fully joking about that, but it is mostly said in jest. But I mean, that will all have to be left to one side when Paul Flynn has to address the competitive imbalance, which Dublin are the poster boy of, I think it's fair to say, of competitive imbalance in the GEA. It is the most worrying development in GEA over the last little while. As great as it has been for Dublin and for the game as a whole, if you're getting stuck into whether or not this is good for a competition in the football championship, it clearly hasn't been. And it's interesting to see how the GPA will tackle that.
Yeah, it is. There's loads of different ways to do it. And it's a massive conversation that really needs everybody's involvement, because you need the weaker counties' voices to be heard. And sometimes with this stuff, it's almost like the players themselves are always going to want to strive to be involved in the big competition for the one-off thing, and somebody from outside might need to come in and say, well, actually, that's never going to happen, so we're not going to give you the opportunity. We're not going to give the Leitrim footballers the opportunity to win the All-Ireland until actually they've proven that they're ready to compete for it. And we know over the course of history and right now at the moment that they're not. Not just picking on Leitrim, any of the Division 4 teams, you would say the same about. Most of the Division 3 teams, you would say the same about. But if those Division 3 teams get their houses in order, there should be a pathway for them to be able to compete for what's up at the very top tier. It's interesting when they were talking about, so I think that the competitive balance and the fixtures issues are essentially, at the moment anyway, very interlocked, because until you actually have a fair set of fixtures and you know when those games are going to be, you can't advise teams on, you can't prescribe teams a set number of contact hours or a set number of training sessions or a set funding, a cap on the spending for that. Let's assume that you were able to police all that, right? Because I think that that's a whole separate conversation. But let's assume you were able to police all that. Would it actually automatically fix things without having the structures of the competitions fixed? I don't think so. And that's why I'm a little bit concerned by the 4-8s being the next phase of competition that might come out of the fixtures. I actually think the correct answer is one of the options, and that's flipping the two seasons, having your provincial competitions be early in the year and then having the summer be a league with the divisions, and then at the end of that you actually have a championship based on league positions. That would be an amazing, absolutely amazing outcome if that was what happens, and that would be fair, because the teams in Division 4 would have a competition that they can win in summertime that offers them a reward of going into Division 3. And likewise, actually, if you win that the way that the fixtures have been designed, you can actually get into the main championship if you go on an amazing run. So, you know, it kind of solves all of the problems. And the funding issue, I think, is actually something that needs to be addressed slightly separately, but is all part of that big conversation. Again, the one thing I would say is that the GPA have become a lightning rod as the organisation who apparently hold within their gift the opportunity to fix all of this. And I don't buy that. I don't buy that the players could go on strike to fix this, because they don't have an agreed template themselves. They don't have the answer. They don't have a single, if there was one single thing that you said the GPA could do and that they're not doing to fix everything, and they didn't do that and they didn't go on strike, I'd say fair enough. But the thing is, their 2,300 members don't all have a single unified idea that is not currently being done. They don't all agree on what the right outcome here is. Some players in Division 4 don't want a second tier competition. Some do. Some players in Division 1 don't care about what happens to the players in Divisions 3 and Divisions 4. So to say that they should be like, we need to fix this because we've got the solution right here, and everybody goes, well, what is the decision? Like, well, we're not sure. Maybe it's a committee. Like, I have... If you think about the history of the GAA, the change never came quickly. It came after years and years and years and years and years of conversation. And there's the soft power and there's the hard power. And which of these two is actually likely to get ideas through more quickly in history in the GAA? Which has actually traditionally been the one that has worked best? I would argue it's the soft power.
The Cork strikes were pretty effective, Ger.
How did the Cork strikes work out for the players?
Okay, fair enough. Look, the first strike.
The Cork footballers were building their own gym 18 months ago, we heard. Remember that story? Yeah. Like, yeah, the Cork strikes did not work.
I think that's open for debate. I think certainly, so there's two strikes. The first strike certainly seemed to have the impact. We don't want to get stuck in
the strike situation.
My point is that I think that there is a possibility for a strike to work. I'm with you on the point, though, that for a strike to work, you need a cause and a singular cause, and you need a certain thing to, you need a hill to die on. What is the hill that the GPA will die on right now? There isn't one, because they're in a mountain range. But that is the situation that the GAA find themselves in. There are a multitude of different problems. It could be the fixtures, it could be the competitive imbalance, it could be the club player getting screwed over year after year, who also fall under the GPA's remit, let's not forget. It's like, while they promote elitism, they are still club players. I'd also question as well the fixtures task force, which, as you say, have picked the provinces being divvied up into four provinces of eight. And that's the one they want to run with now. Fair enough. But I wonder if we need to pause a little again and actually look at what's happening right now and think to ourselves, is this part of the solution? Is part of the solution actually getting the club player and sorting out the situation there first before the GPA can actually act and figure out what fixture reform they want to bring to intercounty football and hurling? That actually what we have right now, this kick-starting the season club style, the GPA probably need to weigh up that first, because Paul Flynn was saying there that he's not sure if that's the best way to go, that perhaps the club season should come afterwards. I wonder if what's happening now is actually something that should impact those fixtures conversations as well. And like on the point of the GPA being a lightning rod, I definitely think it is difficult for one organisation to represent everybody who has so many different interests at the moment. I think the GPA is definitely best served to serve the likes of Dublin and Mayo, as I said yesterday, and your Corks and Kilkennys and the elite counties. I'm not sure if they're
I don't buy that at all. I think that, to be honest, so what you're suggesting is that there'd be another organisation that somehow represents players who are less elite but also elite to the point where they're playing intercounty. Like, that's just another layer of bureaucracy in the middle of all this. And I actually think that, to be fair to them, the figure that they highlighted of something like 1,500 individuals of their 2,300 members had accessed their services, like, that's their role. That's their main function is to help the lives of players who play intercounty football. This other aspect of them, where they're supposed to be a lobby group, is a completely different aspect of the business that they're involved in. And it's the one that we all talk about more often than we talk about what probably takes up, I would say, 95% of their time, which is representing players and players' interests and sorting out grants and sorting out they didn't get their boots allowance. And there was, you know, there's 20 odd instances of them intervening in disputes. Much better to have that as a single organisation, I would argue, because then that organisation has the power and the clout to be able to say, well, if there's a separate organisation for the Dublins, like, do you somehow get promoted from one organisation to the other?
Yeah, but look, my point here is on that exact thing, on the lobbying, on the GPA's input into the fixtures task force. And like, yeah, I did mention off air yesterday that is there a possibility that there should be a middle tier? There's a reason I didn't mention it on air is because I'm not sure. I was only floating that idea yesterday. But I was just an idea. Like, of course, it doesn't make any sense to actually bring in another layer of bureaucracy. It was just one idea. So I don't know. Like, I just think that when they're actually having these conversations in the fixtures task force, it's very, very hard. And I'm just talking about this specific issue now. I'm not talking about the GPA as a whole, because obviously the services that they offer are fantastic. And we don't actually know the full service to your Division 3 and 4 counties when it comes to if they ever have a mental health issue, if they need treatment on an injury and there needs to be finance for it. I'm sure they're all fantastic. I'm talking about a very specific issue here, which is the fixtures. I would just find it very hard to lobby on behalf of everybody who are in very different situations, because the fixtures as they stand right now suit Dublin perfectly.
So
they got their extra games in the Super 8s, and this is not about Dublin. Like, they suit the big counties perfectly. I just find in the specific fixtures conversation, it is very hard to represent everybody.
And so what their strategy seems to be is that they're going to wield soft power from within, and they're going to be part of the fixtures review committee, and they're going to lobby their members and go on a roadshow and say, these are the three options. And then it's kind of, it's the slow, methodical way that democracy works. And it's not very interesting, and it's not very sexy, and it's not we're going to go on strike unless we get this, because being in a perpetual strike means that you can't actually be trusted as an organisation. Like, what are you going to strike on next? Like, you know, a series of referendums on something doesn't tend to produce the best form of stability as we have seen from history.
Can I just ask you one question there? You're right in what you're saying, but who's actually suggesting a strike at the moment? When has that been suggested in recent times?
I think a lot of the criticism is like they're not militant enough, and that they haven't had enough, they haven't threatened to wield their power that much. And it was interesting to hear Paul Flynn say that our relationship with Croke Park is constantly under review. But equally, like, you know, they can't tell us when they're having a row with Croke Park all the time, because if they did, if they were to leak that to the media, then all of a sudden, when you're actually going in for negotiations, who trusts who? Like, Donal O'Neill was really interesting about the, yeah, of course you become compromised when you take the money, but the whole point of setting up the organisation was to get the money. And we all seem to think that compromise is a bad word, when actually that's how progress happens, where people give a little bit on one side, people give a little bit on the other, you meet in the middle, everybody's unhappy about the stuff they've given up. But fundamentally, there's a stability in the relationship that allows everybody to progress and go forward.
Especially the situation that the GPA find themselves in now, or that they've created over the last little while, where they've decided that getting extra funding from the GEA and being partners with them was the way to go. You're not really going to achieve anything by being at loggerheads from that standpoint, but compromise can be achieved easier from that point of view as well. I tend to agree with you. I still think that if there is to be a moment in the future where there is a particular sticking point, that is when we might see a more militant GPA. Like, if you go militant on one thing, you suddenly realise, oh, we've earned that, but now we've not got the opportunity to solve the myriad other problems that the organisation also has.
Say, for example, we got to a scenario where the fixtures task force, the roadshow happens, and the players want one aspect of it to happen, and then everybody agrees that that should happen, and then it gets to Congress and it fails, right? At that point, you would say, we as a group now have this mandate to go on strike, or this mandate to push things through. I don't feel like they have a mandate to go on strike and threaten, okay, well, unless we get this fixed right now, without there being a clear vision and a shared vision that isn't going to annoy all of the grassroots. If they were to say this competitive balance issue needs to be sorted by taking all the funding away from the top tier counties or whatever it is, like, we don't know what the idea is. I don't think you can rally the posse unless you have a very clear idea and a mandate for what it is that the outcome is supposed to be. So, look, I think they're stuck between a rock and a hard place in many aspects, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, because fundamentally people seem to have issue with the amount of money that the leaders in the GPA get paid. It comes up again and again in the papers when you read it. It comes up again and again from the columnists who are the former inter-county players who are like, well, I could do that job.
Like, I mean, there's no argument to be had here about whether or not the GPA get criticism. Like, they get abuse left, right and centre, certainly in the media anyway. I would actually like to, I'd like to know what the average inter-county player, every inter-county player thinks of the GPA. Just, it'll never be a poll, that'll never happen, but what do you think of GPA? Give them a rating out of 5. Very interested to hear that, because there is a lot of sniping when it comes to the GPA, and maybe some of that is right quite often, but there's no question that they're probably the most maligned organisation in Gaelic games if you read the papers and listen to us quite often. I mean, it's hard sometimes to actually know what is the view, because a lot of what they do is behind the scenes, and what we've mentioned with workshops with players and all that sort of thing. Like, it is a welfare organisation, and maybe it deserves a bit more credit on that front.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.